thing in ADKT 0580 specifically regarding the recommendations made by the Commission on Nevada Rules of Appellate Procedure regarding proposed changes to those rules. We did get some written public comments in that regard, and we'll have some oral comments today. I do want to start the hearing by thanking Justice Pickering for her long-suffering work as chair of this commission. Having worked together previously on the committee regarding the rules of civil procedure, I know that it is an arduous task to go through a set of rules like this and try to look holistically at how it's working and what changes should be recommended. So I do thank her very much on behalf of the court for the work that she has done. And I'm going to turn it over to Justice Pickering for some opening remarks as chair.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice Kadish. The NRAP Revision Commission was formed in August of 2021. Its charge was to undertake a comprehensive review of the Nevada Rules of Appellate Procedure to make recommendations for revisions as appropriate. It's been my singular privilege to chair this commission. Originally, Justice Silver was my co-chair, but when she took senior status, I was privileged to have Judge Bonnie Bulla and Judge Deborah Westbrook of the Court of Appeals step up and become the vice chairs of this commission. They are on the bench in the Las Vegas courtroom and in support of today's hearing. Before we get underway, on behalf of the court as a whole, I want to thank those who volunteered their time on this project. Commission members include distinguished appellate practitioners from all walks of Nevada practice, criminal, civil, family law, public sector, private sector, the Nevada Supreme Court Clerk's Office, its central legal staff, and the judiciary. In addition to Judges Bulla and Westbrook, the members of this commission include Chief Judge Michael Gibbons, who cannot be here today, he's out of the country, and attorneys Sally Bassett, Alexander Chen, Sharon Dickinson, Kelly Dove, Micah Eccles, Robert Eisenberg, David Figler, Charlie Finlayson, Travis Gerber, Adam Hosner-Henner, Phaedra Kalicki, Debbie Leonard, Emily McFarlane, Erica Medley, Julie Olam, John Petty, Dan Polsenberg, Steve Silva, Abraham Smith, Jordan Smith, Don Springmeyer, David Stanton, Jonelle Thomas, Jessica Whalen, and Colby Williams. I wanted to read all their names because the court is truly in their debt. The amount of work and effort that these people put in on this commission has just been remarkable. Some background is helpful to understand the scope of this project. Nevada adopted the Rules of Appellate Procedure in 1973, and they were based loosely on the counterpart Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure. Over the next 50 years, we added to them, changed some of them, repealed some, and amended others. But it was kind of like a house getting built on with no direct plan of it. So we had never gone back and looked at the overall structure comprehensively, and that was the charge that the petition tasked this commission with. The commission divided into subcommittees and met monthly as a whole committee for the past 2.5 years to conduct that review. The agendas, minutes, and drafts were published on the commission's webpage, which is maintained on the court's website. And all of that is there available as historical data if anyone wants to consult and understand the rationales that were articulated. We were assisted, the commission, by Sharon Coates, who is the judicial executive assistant in Justice Bell's chambers, and she did a truly remarkable job coordinating with Sally Bassett on getting all the minutes out that record faithfully what the debates were in the committee and what the rationales were for the committee to adopt the recommendations they did. Once the revisions were approved, we collected them into drafts, clean and redlined, and attached them to the petition that was filed on January 29, 2024. For the most part, the recommended revisions were unanimous. There are a few that were not unanimous, and where that occurred, the division was noted in the reviewers' comments that are appended to the rules. On March 4th, we sent out a notice because we had updated everything, but we then discovered that there was a discrepancy between the rules posted on the AOC website page and what was attached to our draft. And that may have affected some of the written comments that we received. So we posted that notice, and the rule, the version of the rules that is the final is that which was attached and filed in this docket. But we have since updated all of those that are shown on the website as well, so they're all in harmony with one another. Some of the rules required no revisions, but and others were just purely updating. For example, the draft recommends that we change NRAP 32 to eliminate the requirement that briefs be covered with colored covers, blue for the appellant, red for the respondent, gray for the reply, and green for the amicus. Those colors and those covers had not been, that had simply been disregarded as a rule requirement. And there were other rules like that in this 50-year-old set of rules we were revising. Those I don't think are going to draw a lot of commentary. Some others were purely stylistic. There was a consensus on the committee, and it, following the track of the FRAP, that we should convert shall to must throughout whenever it would be not be awkward. So those kinds of changes are also noted in the red lines, and they can be distracting, but those are what I would call purely stylistic. But the other changes were substantive, and some of those changes, but not all of the substantive changes, were the subject of public comment. We received written public comments, and I was surprised, given the scope of this work, that we only received five, and I think that's a testament to all of the input that we got from the many expert appellate lawyers who comprised this commission. But the ones we did get were helpful, and I think they all look forward to getting the best product possible. We received written comments from the Federal Public Defender, the Clark County Public Defender, the Legislative Counsel Bureau, the Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice, and the Legal Aid Society, or Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. And I'm given to understand that each of them wishes to address the court orally today. There are members of the commission in attendance in Carson City. We have at council table Julie Olam and Sally Bassett, and the court's debt of gratitude towards them is enormous. Julie Olam has worked night and day to get these rules into shape. She's been on subcommittees, she's drafted, she's debated, and she's been at every meeting. And the same is true for Sally Bassett as well. She's been working on maintaining the website. They are more deeply versed in the actual changes that were made here than probably anyone else, because they've worked with the drafts and kept this project on track, and we are in their debt. They are here available today to answer questions if they come up, not to make statements or to talk about particular revisions, but we weren't sure what issues would arise, and they are here as a resource, and I very much appreciate them being here. Thank you. We also have Judges Bulla and Westbrook in Las Vegas. Judge Westbrook chaired some of the subcommittees, particularly on the criminal practice rules, and that was even before she became a judge on the Court of Appeals, and she's continued that interest after she's been a judge and served as vice chair. And Judge Bulla has worked closely as well, and has reached out trying to straighten out the ongoing issues with Rule 9 and transcripts. I want to mention on a couple of the rules. There are comments that we received on Rule 10, which have to do with sealed records, and I had alerted Chief Justice Kadish to this. We have a pending case that is pending on rehearing that has to do with access to records And if we get into questions about that, given the pendency of that case, it may be that we're not able to participate in that because of a risk of an ex parte issue that could arise. So if that gets called out, that's what that's about. But beyond that, I really just want to thank so much everybody who worked on this. I think it was a monumental project, and it's one that I take great pride in, and I know that my colleagues on the commission do as well. And with that, I'll turn it back to Chief Justice Kadish.
Thank you so much. Okay. So we will go ahead and open it for public comment. I do have some who've identified themselves as wanting to speak today. I will be calling those in just a moment. We, in the interest of time this afternoon, we are limiting each speaker to 3 minutes, so the clock will be running on the speakers that we have. And so I'm just going down the list that I was provided for speakers. The first one I have on the list is Sharon Dickinson. Is Ms. Dickinson there in Las Vegas?
Yes, she is.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and come on up.
With the court's permission, could I ask the court to call Kelly Dove first, only because she has to run out of here and catch a flight, an airplane flight? And I'll speak after her.
Sure. Happy to have Kelly Dove. Ms. Dove, if you would come on up, and then we'll take Ms. Dickinson thereafter.
And at the risk of doing musical chairs, I'm really here to speak to any issues that come up about Rule 9, and so I'm happy to just spend a couple minutes, and I don't want to preempt the Legal Aid Center's comments in that regard, but just wanted to share some of our rationale with respect to that rule. We had a couple goals in our pro se and pro bono subcommittee. One was to place pro se litigants on equal or not disadvantaged footing with other litigants and sort of not giving them a second class citizen status. And another goal, particularly with Rule 9, was to streamline the process by which individuals seeking transcripts prepared at county expense, either because they had informa pauperis status and or they were represented by legal aid, would not have to go back and forth from the district court to the appellate courts and back to the district court to get these transcripts prepared at county expense. And so there's significant structural changes to that rule, making a red line difficult to follow, but we structured the rule so that instead of separating litigants between pro se and represented, the litigants in Rule 9 are now more separated by people who are preparing, asking for transcripts to be prepared at county expense versus people, parties, whether represented or not, who are paying for the preparation of their own transcripts. We believe we tried to and succeeded in streamlining that process as much as possible. I understand and had conversations with the good people at Legal Aid as we were revising this rule, and I understand they have an interest in eliminating some of the steps in that process to make it easier to obtain those transcripts. It was our subcommittee's view that under NRS 12015, that, and I can't recall the subpart and don't have an electronic source here to look at, but that it indicates that there needs to be a court order for those transcripts to be prepared at county expense, and the statute indicates that the court shall order transcripts that would be helpful to the appeal if an individual is IFP or represented by legal aid. And so we felt like even though it would simplify the process to not require an order, it was our reading of the statute that was required. We don't have, I believe, strong feelings about some of the other changes, but we were, again, trying to stay within the confines of that legal, of that statute that authorizes the preparation of transcripts at county expense. And the last subpart of that statute indicates that the people who fall within a client for legal aid are represented by a legal aid organization or under the auspices of similar organizations and are being represented by reason of indigency. And that is why the language in Rule 9 closely tracks the language in that statute to track track that legislative allowance. We, of course, defer to the court in terms of whether that might be able to be broadened to more broadly serve clients of legal aid, which, of course, we all want to support. But that was our reasoning for keeping that. And thank you to Sharon for allowing me to go and for the court's indulgence. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Did anyone have questions for Ms. Dev? No. Okay. Thank you so much, and hope you make your flight.
I will. Thank you.
Okay, then. Ms. Dickinson is next.
Good afternoon, court. My name is Sharon Dickinson. At the time I was working on these proposed appellate rules, I was with the Clark County Public Defender's Office. And I can tell you I attended almost all of the meetings except for perhaps three. But I was actually not officially a board member, commission member, until March 1st of 23. That's when I joined the commission. Before that, I was attending the subcommittees. With regard to NRAP 36, I want to comment on whether or not all the published decisions should be cited. I was not part of the commission at that time, and I did not hear that hearing. I wasn't there. The reason I oppose citing all published decisions ever made by the court is because, one, it's contrary to the way the federal rules are set up. If you look at the federal rules, specifically Rule 32.1, you'll see that when the federal courts decided to start citing published decisions, they did it prospectively. And if you look at that rule, it says that it has to be a decision that was issued after January 1st, 27. The rule was enacted in 2006. So I would ask that the court do the same with our rules. We already did that with the Nevada Supreme Court unpublished decisions, and they were citable after, I believe it's 2016. So if the court is going to decide to cite to the cases from the Court of Appeals, then I would ask that it be prospective rather than retroactive. Mm-hmm. I would say this decision is also, or this proposal is also contrary to NRAP 0504, which specifically stated that the decisions from the Court of Appeals would not be, unpublished decisions would not be cited. Obviously, if the court wants to change it, it can. However, we've been relying on that, as have our clients in the Public Defender's Office. As the court, I'm sure, knows, a lot of the cases that we had in the criminal area are the habeas, and they're normally pro se. They are representing themselves. And so they've been doing this, filing documents and representing themselves, and the court has been making decisions based on their legal arguments, not frequently based on what an attorney would do. So I would ask that they not be citable except prospectively. I had one other comment that I wanted to make, and that's with regard to Rule 4, if I may.
Go ahead quickly.
Quickly. I agree with part of what the Clark County Public Defender's Office says about Rule 4A. I had objected to this portion of Rule 4A when I was on the commission. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. All right. The next speaker I had on my list is Kevin Powers, who is present here in Carson City.
Thank you, Your Honors. For the record, Kevin Powers, General Counsel, LCB Legal. 3 minutes, not a lot of time, so I'm going to go quickly. I'm not going to go over our written comments because obviously the court has them before them. LCB Legal is willing to provide supplemental comments dealing with some drafting issues that LCB Legal came across after reviewing the rules top to bottom yesterday, in particular except clauses that should have cross-references to the other rules where the exceptions apply. So LCB Legal would offer, with the court's permission, to submit supplemental comments dealing only with those technical drafting issues. I'll leave it to the court's discretion. With regard to the definition of pro se, the committee is expanding pro se to say pro se or unrepresented. However, there's many other terms that represent pro se or unrepresented throughout the rules. So I would suggest that definition be pro se or unrepresented or any other similar term. There's self-represented, there's party not represented by counsel, and et cetera. That should capture all of those terms. I'm going to finish with NRAP 4 because that's the jurisdictional time limit. I just want to see if there's anything else I want to capture. I'll say this about the use of the term indices. Indexes is actually a preferred version of the plural of index, and so I would suggest it's easier to pronounce and more commonly used if the court changed indices to indexes. Finally, Rule 4 and the changing of the provision with regard to allowing an extension by the district court of the time to file the notice of appeal. When this court adopted the Nevada rules in 1973, the advisory committee note specifically provided that the advisory committee found that adoption of the extension provision was unnecessary and undesirable under Nevada practice. LCB Legal agrees with that. A hard jurisdictional limit is much more appropriate. You avoid the litigation that requires the parties to go through if someone seeks an extension during the bonus 30-day period. If you look at the federal case law, it's severely conflicted after 50 years of having this provision. The circuits are split in a lot of ways on how to interpret good cause or excusable neglect. And we believe that it's just going to result in a lot more case law and decisions that unnecessarily extend appeals for potentially years. I think the biggest thing is we're recommending extend the jurisdictional time period for the appeal. Filing appeal is simple. You file a 4-page document, and that's all you need to do to perfect the appeal. If you don't file the fee, the court still accepts the appeal. You don't file a case appeal statement, the court still accepts the appeal. It's a simple process. If people need additional time to seek appellate counsel and determine whether they want to appeal, put it in the jurisdictional time limit. Adopt the multiples of seven approach. LCB Legal recommends 63 days to file the notice of appeal. If you like a round number, go to 70. It's just a hard and fast limit. It's easy to apply, and you don't result in unnecessary litigation over whether or not someone can appeal. Thank you.
So, Mr. Parris, thank you, and I would say it's okay if you want to submit technical type edits, although the time for public comment has passed. Those kind of technical things I expect would assist us in finalizing this, so thank you for
Yes, I will submit those before 11:59 p.m. this evening.
Oh, awesome. Thanks
thank
so much.
Thank you so much for your comments.
Okay. Next on my list is Scott Coffey on behalf of NACJ. Mr. Coffey, are you there in Vegas? Aha.
I am, Justice. Good afternoon. My name is Scott Coffey. I am here on behalf of Nevada Attorneys Criminal Justice. Many of you know me. I've spent about 25 years in practice. It's not primarily focused on appeals, but when we learned about the rule changes and this Herculean task that has been undertaken by this court, first off, I'd like to say that the organization applauds the effort. We decided the members should take a look. I was designated as liaison. I sent a email out essentially to our listserv and took comments from people. Shockingly, as detailed as this document is, we only had two primary comments, and one of them I was not honestly very sure about at first, which is whether the citing to unpublished orders from the Court of Appeals should be prospective or whether it should go back to the creation of the court. The Court of Appeals has done some great work, and some of the old opinions would be useful. I concede as much. But from talking to people who practice in this area more often than I do, it was virtually unanimous that they would like a start date to know when things should start moving forward when the opinions could be citable. One of the things that was pointed out to me that we mentioned in the letter is that sometimes the authors, with this being an error correction court, there are some lengthy opinions, there are some very cursory opinions from the Court of Appeals very early on. If we set a perspective date going forward, everybody is on the same page and knows what we're going to get. It's what the Supreme Court did in 2015, 2016, when they started allowing us to cite unpublished orders. So that was the rationale for that. And again, our practitioners were virtually unanimous. Not quite unanimous. My wife tried to convince me against it, in all candor. But we were close to unanimous. The other issue that we have has to do with just a clarity issue, and it has to do with the mailbox rule as embodied in Rule 4D. That makes clear that indigent defendants have some leeway for filings. If you look at Rule 25, that leeway is not clear, and there's no citation that cross-references Rule 4 to Rule 25, or Rule 25, Rule 4. We would ask you that the mailbox language from Rule 4 be included in the exact provision of 25, or that it at least be referenced, because it causes some confusion for our practitioners. If it causes confusion for people that do this all the time, I suspect it will cause confusion for others, and it'd be better to clarify now than have a debate for later. I know there's a difference between electronic and paper filing that was mentioned. One of the concerns, of course, is these rules are going to carry on. It's been 40 or 50 years since they've been changed. Electronic filing, while it may not be available now to the incarcerated, I expect that it might be sometime in the near future, and I think it will be smart to make sure that the rules are clear for that point in time in the future. And with those comments, I would again, congratulate you on this Herculean effort.
Mr. Coffey, if you would just hang on for a moment, I believe Justice Pickering has a couple questions for you.
I do. Thank you for your comments very much. I was trying to envision, I agree with your concerns as stated with respect to NRAP 25 and the mailbox rule, and that's a helpful rule. We're trying not to put in extra words where we don't need to, but I think it's helpful to do so there. Would you be able to draft something that in that as a proposed rule of revision and send it to the commission that would put into text what you're stating in your letter?
Yes, absolutely. Assuming I can ask for help from some people more familiar than me.
Yeah, because I wasn't quite clear what that would look like, and it seems that you're really familiar with that, and that would be a big help. So if we could set a deadline on that, say the next week, would that be possible to do? 2 weeks?
Could 2 weeks if I could. My children are on spring break.
Perfect.
And I'm going out of town.
If that works. And then I wanted to clarify, is it the case that you support citation of unpublished Court of Appeals orders, but only from the date of the effective date of the rules forward? Or are you opposed altogether to the citation of them?
No, we support unpublished orders from the Court of Appeals from the date of adoption, just so everybody's on the same page. I think it's useful in the right circumstance. So as long as everybody's on the same page and knows that they might be cited, it would be going forward. We're in support
and
of that.
Then you would leave in place the January 1, 2016 date for the citability of the Supreme Court's unpublished decisions as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Coffey. All right. Next on my list here, I have William Waters. Mr. Waters.
Good afternoon. I just on behalf of the Public Defender's Office, I do want to acknowledge really the tremendous work that the commission did. I know Deborah personally. She actually worked for me. I was her boss. And she is one of the brightest, most capable appellate attorneys I've ever worked with. So any of my comments were not meant to disparage the work of the commission whatsoever. I'm going to just address Rule 4. There's Ms. Dickinson alluded to it briefly, but the idea that the defendant would have an opportunity to file a notice of appeal once the state files a notice of appeal. I just, as a practical matter, I don't know when that would ever happen. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. If someone can point something out to me. But my understanding is based on the NRS and so forth, that we can only appeal final orders. whereas the state can appeal both final orders and certain pretrial orders. And so if the state appeals a final order, it would probably have been beneficial to us. There'd be no need for us to appeal.
Mr. Waters, I have a question for you on that point. I think that what the history of that was addressing post-conviction, where it's granted in part and denied in part, and the state may have a right of appeal in that instance. And with that, I want to get your thoughts on whether that would make sense within the context of the rule. That is my notes from when that rule was discussed.
That makes a lot more sense. That's not clear to me, at least in the rules. So maybe if there, we could offer some clarification. Sometimes you do get pro per defendants who might see that and be like, well, look, I had 30 days after the state filed its notice to file a notice, and I want to file some, you know, pro per brief or something like that. Whereas I could probably discern that rule wouldn't necessarily still allow me to do it. Someone else might not.
That's clarification's a good point. I think we need to have it in there, but I think we need to clarify it. I agree with you on that. Thank you.
And then I would just note in my written comments, I mentioned the proposed changes to NRAP 4B3A. There's, to me at least, and again, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, so maybe I'm just not reading this correctly, but it seems to conflict a little bit with NRAP 4B5. Which is the filing motions, post judgment motions, then will extend the deadline. But 4B5 seems to suggest you still have to get your notice of appeal in 30 days after the judgment of conviction. So again, if I'm misreading this, I understand. I might not be reading it correctly, but if I'm not, I just think it's a little confusing, and maybe some clarification might be warranted.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks. Next is Scott Cardenas with Legal Aid Center.
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing us the chance to comment on the proposed changes to the Nevada Rules of Appellate Procedure. I'll do my best to keep our comments brief. My name is Scott Cardenas. I'm a staff attorney with the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, and I'm here with my colleague, Michael Wendelberger, who is the directing attorney for the pro bono project with the Legal Aid Center. So if the court has any questions on pro bono, I might have to defer to Michael on that. We're here on behalf of the Legal Aid Center and the Nevada Coalition of Legal Services Providers, and the comments we submitted focus on two issues that have become reoccurring problems for both the pro bono community and for our attorneys representing clients through other court-approved programs. Those two issues are the complications and costs in requesting transcripts, and also the multitude of obstacles in place when trying to obtain records in district court cases that were sealed. It's our position that any barriers to pro bono or other legal aid representation really presents a access to justice issue, and it affects the most disadvantaged populations in our community. And so with that in mind, the changes that we suggested, really the goal was just to streamline the process as much as possible for those parties. To achieve this goal, we suggest simplifying both NRAP 9 and NRAP 11 by really allowing the order appointing pro bono counsel or the statement of legal aid representation to really kind of serve as the key for anything that counsel might need in the case in regards to the record for the appeal. I'll be careful about talking about the sealed records issue since I know that issue was noted at the beginning. What I will say is right now there's a pretty complicated multi-step process that counsel has to go through when the underlying district court case is sealed. There's motions that have to be filed in the district court. There's notices of appearance, different kinds of filings that have to be filed just to get your hands on the record for appeal. In regard to the transcript rule, NRAP 9, I will say that we don't necessarily disagree with the commission's rationale. I know Ms. Stubb noted those rationales. What I will say is that I think our goal is to maybe just go a step further in streamlining the process and making it easier for pro bono attorneys and legal aid attorneys. I don't know if, you know, if the concern is that that language needs to be in an order, then maybe there could be a solution where it's included in the initial order for pro bono counsel. There could be language in there about the waiver of costs, about, you know, access to the sealed records, anything like that, to alleviate that issue. You know, I maybe this is just the first analogy that comes to mind for me because I litigate in adult guardianship mainly. But in those cases, right at the outset of the case, we get an order appointing counsel that is kind of our access key to anything that we need about our client, whether it's bank records, police records, APS records. It would be really burdensome if we had to, you know, seek a separate order for any kind of record we might need. So I think, you know, a similar kind of structure in that order appointing pro bono counsel might be helpful and streamline the process more.
Thank you.
If the court has any questions or anything, I'm happy to answer those.
I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Those are all the folks that I have on the speaker list. As
I think Federal Public Defender as well.
Okay. Is there someone from the Federal Public Defender's Office? They did submit written comments. Did somebody wish to speak?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Hi, Your Honors. Randy Fiedler from the Federal Public Defender's Office. I did not sign up to speak, but I did come to show my support for the rule changes. And
sorry, you're speaking very fast. Can I have your name again?
Randy Fiedler on behalf of the Federal Public Defender. I was not.
Can you spell your last name, Mr. Fiedler?
Sorry. F as in Frank, I-E-D-L-E-R.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Thank you.
I was just going to say I was not planning on speaking, but I'm happy to answer any questions related to our written comments, which had to do with the routing statements for whether a case tracks to the Nevada Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, and requests for stay of remitter pending petition for writ of certiorari. Right.
Does anyone have any questions regarding the FPD comments filed February 29?
I do.
Okay.
This is Justice Pickering, and I want to thank you for your comments, which were really helpful. Mm-hmm. The question I have on the stay of remitter is you're taking language from the federal counterpart or cognate to this rule with reference to a substantial question, but I wonder if it should have some reference to a federal question in that, because the context wouldn't be immediately clear to a reader. So I had that question for you.
So I would view that the federal part is being encompassed by substantial, because if you're only going to get a cert granted on a federal question. But I certainly don't think it would hurt to add the word federal to the language to clarify.
Thank you.
Anything else for Mr. Fiedler? Nope. All right. Thanks so much. We appreciate you being here and for submitting your written comments.
Thank you.
Okay. Those are all the noted speakers we had, but is there anyone else there present in Las Vegas who was wanting to speak today?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Kadish, Dan Pulsberg. I apologize. I was not planning on speaking until I saw the criminal justice lawyer's comments about unpublished opinions. I'm in favor of citing unpublished opinions without limitation. I think everybody on the commission knows, I think, that. The only restrictions lawyers have are certain unpublished decisions of this court. Now, there is a misunderstanding that the federal rules prohibit citing cases before a certain date. No, the Federal Rule 32.1 says a court may not prohibit citing cases issued on or after January 1st, 2007. I'll tell you the story behind that, because in the 1990s and early 2000s, I was on the Ninth Circuit Rules Committee. There was a debate every year on whether to cite unpublished opinions. Certain judges, including Judge Kaczynski, was against that idea because it would inhibit the way judges write opinions. So the National Rules Committee came in and said, okay, a court cannot prohibit after a certain date. Courts are free in the federal system to allow the citation of any unpublished decision. The Ninth Circuit in their Circuit Rule 36 says, okay, you can't cite cases before that date except for res judicata or collateral estoppel. I think you should be allowed to cite anything. And I'm surprised lawyers that face challenging cases would disagree with that idea, because sometimes you just need to find anything that will support your position. The court is free to reject it and say, well, that's not persuasive, or I didn't mean that when I said that. There's a story I tell when I teach seminars about Prosser. If you look at Prosser and Keaton, fifth edition, you see this one concept. It may have been strict liability. And it cites in a footnote the really big cases from the really big courts. You go to the fourth edition, and it's a whole lot of cases from middle-level courts. You go to the third edition, it's just a few cases. The second edition cites one, and the first edition cites nothing. Yeah. And you go to that case cited in the second edition, and the only thing it cites is Prosser's first edition. We shouldn't be restricted in what we can do to try to develop an idea. Yes, some judges don't like the idea of limiting their writing style when they come up with opinions. Judge Kaczynski used to say, well, in unpublished orders, I'm just not going to say anything, so nobody can cite it. These courts have never had that mentality. I think we've got 8 years of citing current unpublished decisions. People point out now we can go all the way back to the 19th century. Well, first of all, there weren't that many unpublished decisions back then. It used to be that every decision from the Supreme Court was published, and there really weren't that many of them anyway. And here on this commission, we have all three judges from the Court of Appeals, and they're not worried about hampering or inhibiting their style in doing this. So I would say let's keep the proposed rule the way it is. Thank you, Chief Justice Kadish.
Thank you, Mr. Polzenberg. Anyone else?
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Catherine Curry-Diamond, and I'm here as the newest member of the appeals team from the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I really appreciate all the work that was done on this commission and for the proposed rule changes. Obviously, some of them updating the rules that are 50 years old is incredibly important for what we do in today's day and age on appeals and writing and arguing arguments. Your Honors, I'm here specifically to speak about Rule 36 and what it could mean practically speaking on a district court level and for trial attorneys. So I think what it could potentially mean is that a district court could potentially deny a meritorious argument by a defendant, even though the unpublished opinions are merely persuasive in nature, not mandatory authority. But as we all know, many cases that start out as just charges, so few of them actually end up in trial. And so many fewer of those end up actually on appeal. But the litigation that happens on the district court level is really sometimes dispositive of those cases and ultimately what happens with those cases. And a lot of those cases and issues are not necessarily seen by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court because so few of them do get there. So practically speaking, Your Honors, we're just concerned about what that could mean on a district court level and what that could mean on a trial court level. And we would encourage the prospective position that Sharon Dickinson and Mr. Scott Coffey took as far as citing unpublished decisions, but also potentially a limiting principle that they can be cited at the appeals court level and not necessarily in the district court level. And that's it.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Chief, may I have the witness spell her name, please?
Oh, ma'am, can you spell your last name, please?
Oh, yes. C-U-R-R-I-E hyphen Diamond, D-I-A-M-O-N-D.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else there in Las Vegas wishing to speak today? Not seeing anyone. Okay. Did Judge Bulla or Judge Westbrook want to add any comments at this point?
No, I think we've heard from some wonderful speakers, and this has been an amazing process. We had a lot of wonderful attorneys putting in a lot of effort over the last 2.5 years, and I'm just grateful for everybody's participation, and thankful that we had such robust comment today.
Thank you. Judge Bulla?
Thank you, Chief Justice Kadish. I do not have anything to add, except I would also like to express my gratitude to all the lawyers who worked on the commission, having also served on the commission to revise the rules of civil procedure. It is an extremely time-consuming task, and we were very grateful for all the input and the opinions that we received. And these rules were discussed thoroughly. The issues, many of which were raised today, were addressed and thought through carefully. And the rules that are submitted to the Supreme Court for consideration are a culmination of hard work, effort, and thought. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just to be thorough, is there anyone else here in Carson City wishing to speak? Okay. Any of the justices have any comments or anything else that they wanted to add? Justice Pickering, did you want to close with any thoughts?
Nothing other than to thank the people who worked on this commission. Special thanks to Julie Olam and Sally Bassett. And thank you to all those who submitted comments and appeared today. It has been a real pleasure and privilege to work with all of you.
Thank you. So I thank again Justice Pickering for having chaired the commission. Thank Judges Bulla and Westbrook for having acted as vice chairs, and all the other members of the commission, as well as all of you who have offered your written comments, your oral comments, and your thoughtful input regarding these important matters. At this time, we will close this public hearing. Thanks so much.